AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction. You might say we're putting a modern twist on this morning's AgriTalk. We're talking Farm Worker Modernization Act and trying to figure out exactly how modern monetary theory is supposed to propel the economy forward. And in segment four, we're just hoping to go backwards to get to the future.
Live from the calm after the quiet storm via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning, we begin with a conversation with U.S. Representative Dan Newhouse. Then it's Dr. Vince Malanga from LaSalle Economics. We've also got Mike Watley from the National Restaurant Association. And right after the news, Greg Henderson from Drovers. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson. And now the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
Yeah, Davis, hey, thank you so much. We've got a lot of ground that we are going to cover today. The American Rescue Plan includes the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. And we're going to have a conversation with Mike Watley. Is this enough? Will this buy restaurant owners enough time to get back to pre-pandemic levels on revenue coming in to their kitchens? Okay. That's the bottom line.
I hope so. I went out to eat for the first time in a long time at like a sit-down steakhouse. Yeah. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was fantastic. I had the outlaw ribeye. And It was a great dining experience. The wait staff seemed very enthusiastic. And I know the public is ready to get out there and get some grub in a sit-down joint.
You bet. And I'm hoping, I don't know if he does or not, but I'm hoping that Michael might have a report or two coming out of Texas where where restaurants have gone back to full capacity.
Yeah.
How's it going? Are people responding? Is that pent-up demand really there? If it is, Davis, this meat market had better get ready. That's the bottom line, isn't it?
We're in week six at 114 in the cash cattle market still.
Right, week six there. Now, we're seeing some reaction in the pork cutout. At least I think we are. But I don't think the pork cutout market is ready for what happens when restaurants start putting bacon back on everything. I mean, you walk into a restaurant in the future, they might just hand you a piece of bacon and say, hey,
Hogs
welcome.
To 100. You heard it here first. Hogs to 100, baby.
Yeah, well, you know, honestly, we're almost there. June, July contracts, $99. So it feels like it's happening. It really does. Okay, there's a lot happening out there. Let's get to it. What you got?
Well, Chip, the House did pass the COVID aid stimulus bill Wednesday afternoon, and it now heads to President Biden's desk, where he is, of course, expected to sign it. That'll be on Friday. Biden said in a statement that he looks forward to signing what he called a, quote, historic piece of legislation on Friday at the White House. The sweeping legislation had no support from Republican lawmakers, who called it bloated and unaffordable. Just one Democrat, Representative Jared Golden of Maine, voted against the final measure, Chip.
And there's already talk of the next package, the $4 trillion stimulus that is being discussed in Washington, D.C. right now.
Well, the U.S. registered a deficit for February of $310.9 billion, putting the cumulative total for fiscal year 2021 at more than $1 trillion. That compares with this point in fiscal 2020, when the deficit was $624 billion. The federal budget gap widened to 68% of the first 5 months of the fiscal year. Expectations are that the new COVID stimulus package, the budget red ink, is again poised to top $3 trillion in fiscal 2021. Despite the rising tide of red ink, the cost to finance the federal debt has declined. Chip?
And that is exactly why we've got Dr. Vince Malanga coming on the show at the bottom of the hour, is to explain how this is all going to work.
Yeah, because it's all Greek to me. The Senate Wednesday afternoon confirmed Michael Reagan as administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. Farm and biofuel groups quickly applauded the confirmation. As Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, Reagan established a reputation as a pragmatic, bipartisan problem solver. Notably, Chip, Senate Ag Appropriations Subcommittee Ranking Member John Hoeven was one of the Republicans who did not vote to confirm Reagan.
Yeah, interesting. You know, keep in mind, when we had the conversation with John Doggett, the CEO of the National Corn Growers Association, after Reagan's name first started to be circulated out there, and then he was nominated by President Biden, he picked up the phone and called Doggett and said, listen, we've got a lot of work to do. Let's get our heads together on how we're going to make it happen. That was a positive sign. I hope this is going to be good for ethanol.
Well, livestock feed prices in China are sinking on concerns that the spread of new strains of African swine fever will slow the recovery of hog herds and curb demand for soybean meal and corn. Dalian soybean meal futures slumped to the lowest in almost 3 months on Thursday, while corn prices fell to the weakest this year in intraday trading. In January, soybean meal hit the highest since 2014, and corn was at a record. Feed prices in China are quite the roller coaster these days, buddy.
Absolutely, and it's one of the black swan things that we've talked about. We talked about it the Commodity Classic last week with Tyne.
Mm-hmm. Well, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken on Wednesday signaled the Biden administration was taking a tough diplomatic posture as it prepares for sensitive discussions with Iran and China on nuclear and human rights issues. Blinken testified before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. On China, Blinken told lawmakers he would take a tough and firm line when he meets next week in Anchorage, Alaska, with Beijing's top foreign policy officials. Chip.
Yeah, interesting that they're going all the way to Alaska for the first official meeting between the Biden administration and Chinese officials. I think it's pretty fascinating. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Davis.
You bet.
Greg Henderson, editorial director at Drovers, joins us right now. Greg, we always talk about beef exports and how beef has become or is an international business. What do you got out there on the international front?
Well, yes, global demand for beef is rising, and we know that, and China is a big customer. So one of Australia's largest suppliers of beef to China has now decided that she's going to put her 7 cattle stations up for sale. Her name is Gina Reinhardt. She's worth approximately $29 billion, give or take $100 million or so, Chip. And she's an heiress to a mining company. So she's also selling 108,000 cattle with those stations.
Wow.
So just to kind of give you some perspective here, I did the math. So I know all 108,000 of those are not cows, but if they were, that would be 45 acres per cow, which is, you know, pretty sparse and desolate country.
Sure is.
And the other thing we relate this to is, so the King Ranch is about 825,000 acres in the United States, and they have about 35,000 cattle. So that gives you some idea of the magnitude of this sale. And obviously, I don't think they expect, you know, one buyer to step in and buy all of it. There is a 20,000 head feed yard involved, but they believe that the export market for beef to China especially is good, and that now is a good time to sell while the market is up. So an interesting take from a billionaire's point of view.
That is interesting. Get out while the getting is good is what it sounds like to me. Greg, interesting stuff. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Chip.
All right. That is Greg Henderson, editorial director at Drovers. We'll be back with Representative Dan Newhouse from Washington next here on AgriTalk.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Clarifly Larvicide, your feed-through fly control solution. AgriTalk is brought to you by Delaro Complete. Keep your operations moving forward with Delaro Complete from Bayer.
Welcome back. I'm Chip. Got Davis Michelson with me. And Davis, we've got a new voice here on AgriTalk. We've not talked with Representative Dan Newhouse, representing the 4th District of Washington before, but we're going to talk with him right now. Congressman, welcome to AgriTalk. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. Yeah, it'll be fun to be and a new audience, a new radio station. So it's good to be with you.
Great. Love it. Love it that you're here. Okay. So this is the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. Is this the carving out of the farm labor issue from the broader plan that commodity groups, from the National Pork Producers Council to the produce growers, that they've been looking for and asking for? Are we going to get this carved out of the broader plan?
The short answer is yes, Chip. As we've proven, we as generally Congress, we can't do comprehensive anything very well. Anytime you use the word immigration on any kind of legislation, it turns it into one of the most hot button issues we deal with. And so to be successful, to respond to the critical situation that we're in as far as agricultural labor in this country, this is absolutely an effort to separate it from all of those other hot button issues so that we can respond with a solution that will help American agriculture.
Okay, you're a co-sponsor on this bill, and it feels like it's got bipartisan support. But Congressman, we've heard that this issue, farm labor in particular, has bipartisan support of let's fix this, let's make something happen. That bipartisan support has been there before. Is it really there this time?
Oh, I think absolutely. This is not something that just happened overnight. We've been working on this issue for several years, actually. And I can even tell you that more than bipartisan support, we have bicameral support. There's a lot of people over in the Senate that are absolutely seeing the situation we're in is urgent. But we also have a tremendous amount, and this is even more important probably, of industry support. And that's on both employers and employees. This was a negotiated product that involved people from labor, people from industry, as well as members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. So I don't know what you call that, by something. It's bipartisan, but it's also a cooperative effort on the part of everybody involved.
There you go. I like that word right there, cooperative effort. The bill provides legal status for the current workforce. How does that work?
So if someone can prove that they've been in this country working in agriculture for a specific period of time and, you know, kept their nose clean, stayed out of trouble, all that, absolutely, they have the opportunity to get right with the law. We've come up with something, a visa called a certified agricultural worker. And with that visa, I come from the state of Washington. Most of our workers come from Mexico. So using that as an example, someone can come up from the south of the border, work the growing season, and then legally go home, return to their families, return to their hometowns, as most of them want to do. Next growing season, they can legally return, come across the border and not have to use the coyote system and all that mess.
Yeah.
Come up here, work legally, and then do it again, return. And that's a 5-year visa, renewable. They can do that for as long as they want.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. What about...
Obviously, Chip, it's not rocket science. We want people to come here legally and work on our farms. That's what we need, a labor force that's legal.
That's right. Now, that is seasonal labor. What about those workers at dairies, at hog farms, slaughterhouses, and so on, that are here full time? Does this apply to those workers as well?
So we have, in this country, it's called the H-2A program for temporary agricultural workers, as you know. And we are... we're making improvements to the H-2A program, and one of those improvements is very significant for those employers that have full-time work, like you mentioned, dairies and hog farms.
Yeah.
We will make them eligible or able to use this H-2A program where they haven't been before. And I've got a lot of dairies in my district. Don't have too many hog farms like the Midwest, but a lot of dairies. And I tell you what, they are in a critical, critical labor shortage, and I'm imagining the hog industry is similar. So this, sure. this response to that allows them to use this program to bring in vital agricultural workers. And if you know anything about the HUA program, they obviously have to be sure that they're not displacing domestic workers, and that's just part of the deal. You need, you hire locally first, domestically. If you can't find people, then you can apply to bring workers in on this temporary visa.
Right, right. See, what I'm thinking about here, Representative Newhouse, are some of those yep. employees that have been at a dairy for years, 10 years. They're sure. part of the fabric of yep. those businesses, but they may not be here legally. Am I hearing you right that they will be able to get legal status? Will they get that certification?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. That's a big part of this, the certified agricultural worker
Good.
Visa, to allow those that, just like you said, have worked, some of them more than 10 years. I've got
oh,
some
yeah.
employees that have been with me for 25 or more years.
Yeah.
But this will allow them that opportunity to earn legal status. And that's a very key thing, because they've become an integral part of our agricultural industry, and we need to be able to have them contribute.
Yep, yep. And even though they're not legal, they are taxpayers. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right. Many of them, they've become parts of our community.
Yeah.
So they pay taxes in a lot of different, local taxes, certainly income taxes, federal taxes, deducted out of their paycheck, and all of those things. So, yes.
Yeah, yeah. We need to find a way to give them that legal certification. I hope that happens. I hope that happens. You said that this is renewable every 5 years. You yes. used the phrase "keep their nose clean." If they stay out of trouble and are contributing, then certification should be. I just hope that it doesn't mean that in 5 years we're going to be back at looking at this and saying, well, you know what, we need to tweak this and tweak that. Let's get something in place that works and stick with it for a while, right?
Well, you're absolutely right about the fact that they are a contributing part of our industry. But we are, providing them this opportunity for legal status. We expect something in return. And part of that is to be a good citizen, a good member, legal member of our community. And so I don't think that's too much to ask to, part of that is to uphold the law, be right. truly live a law abiding life. That's why there's the renewal process, that their individual cases are reviewed
Excellent.
On a regular basis.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay, let's go to the broader policy and try to describe. I'm not even going to try to describe what's going on down on the border right now, Congressman. What is the situation?
There's a group of us going down to the border to see firsthand next week, so we'll have a clearer picture other than what we see on the news, which is I'm seeing the same thing you are. It looks like it's. Well, some of the policies that this administration are putting into place is essentially inviting people to come illegally, and that's untenable. The number of people that they're apprehending crossing illegally is dramatically higher than it was just 2 months ago, and so it's truly a crisis situation. In the bigger picture, too, this legislation that we're talking about will, in fact, remove much of the incentive for people to come to this country illegally. Because if you look at the end of the bill, there's a provision, Title III, phases in the requirement to use the electronic verification system. Okay. If we have a legal source of workers, and we have laws concerning coming into this country, we need to enforce them. And if someone comes in illegally, they're not going to be able to work in agriculture unless they have their visa. And so that is going to, I think, lessen some of the pressure at the border.
Okay. Excellent. Congressman, after you make that trip down to the border, if you've got some insights that you could share with us, we'd sure appreciate a phone call.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah, absolutely. We're hoping to see firsthand exactly what's going on and come away with some, you know, talking about what solutions we right. see need to be put in place.
Excellent. Thank you, Good. Sir. That is Representative Dan Newhouse, 4th District of Washington. Good new voice right here on AgriTalk.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
Joining us, Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Beach, a little bit of strength come back into the grain markets.
Yeah, in some of them, Chip. I want to start in the soy complex. It's more of what we've talked about here recently. And soy oil sprinting to the upside, the meal market pulling to the downside, and you got beans kind of caught in the middle, slightly favoring the upside at the moment. But that action, spreading action in the soy product markets is really just continues to be very aggressive. And meal on the short end of that leg and soy oil on the long end. Now, historically, that hasn't been one of staying power in the soy complex. Usually the best rallies are meal led, so keep that in mind.
Right. But that oil chart is bottom left, top right, and it's an impressive move that we've got going right now.
Absolutely. And we'll see how much longer it continues. But it's just all kinds of factors coming into play there in that market.
Right. We've got some double-digit losses going in the wheat market as well. Anything standing out in that market?
Well, I think it's the precip that's coming to the central plains and maybe some of the southern plains. Heavy snows and rains are forecast here. And so I think that would give that winter wheat crop, needed moisture as it starts to green up.
Right. Nice. Solid gains in lean hogs.
Oh, absolutely. New contract highs, sprinting to the upside, and funds have been aggressive buyers there. Pretty quiet action in the cattle market so far this morning with mixed trade. And beef and pork export sales were down from the previous week, but they were very good levels still.
Yeah, still at good levels. Thanks, Brian. That's Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady on Markets Now.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Bayer. For a strong start, trust the tried and true protection of Corvus and harness extra herbicides from Bayer.
Welcome back. Glad that you are with us today. Davis is with us as well, and he will rejoin us along with Dr. Vince Malanga right after this Industry Spotlight. Blake Bergkamp is the Great Plains agronomist. He joins us right now. Blake, there's been a lot of change up in tillage practices out there. What is driving those changes?
Hi, Chip. I think there's several things we've seen over the past decade or so in shift from intensive tillage over to more reduced tillage and no-till practices. Part of that being farm size. We've seen farm sizes increasing. Another area is earlier planting dates, and part of that could be due to changing weather patterns as well as seed technology and genetics allowing earlier planting of these corn and soybean genetics. Thirdly is improved soil health.
Absolutely, yeah. And through all of that, there's going to be some side benefits. How is it benefiting the farmer?
First being reduction in time or labor that it takes to get across the field and prepare that seed bed for the upcoming crop, able to do that in fewer passes with these hybrid or vertical style tools. Another area is from the economic standpoint, and that it is costly. It takes a lot of fuel and labor and time to make those tillage passes, and anything they can do to reduce the number of trips across the field can be beneficial to their operations.
All right. So what are features that a farmer should consider when buying a hybrid tillage tool?
First, look at what type of performance are they looking for. Are they wanting more soil mixing or processing of that residue? Are they looking for a great seedbed finish or maybe a combination of both? We have a lot of different options ranging from variable intensity tools that change gang angle to tools that have fixed gang angle. And then I think lastly, just need to remember productivity. These tools work at faster speeds, so needing a farmer to understand what they're looking for from the speed side, how fast they're looking to go with the tools.
Great. Okay, so where do we go for more information?
Visit us at greatplainsag.com or reach out to the local Great Plains dealer.
Thank you. That is Blake Bergkamp, Great Plains agronomist. All right, Davis, we have been talking about what's going on in the economy and the amount of spending, and we're running through some of these numbers, and it just blows me away how big they really are. I mean, you had it in the news this morning, the cumulative total of the fiscal year 2021 deficit is over $1 trillion.
It's more than a trillion dollars already. Compared to $624 billion in fiscal 2020.
Right. And we were spending like crazy in fiscal 2020. And we continue to spend even crazier. How are we doing it? Let's bring in Dr. Vince Malanga. He's the president of LaSalle Economics out of New York. Vince, it's good to talk with you again. How are you?
Good. How you doing, Chip?
Well, I'm scratching my head trying to figure out how we are doing this. And all I keep hearing is that, well, it's the modern monetary theory that we can just continue to print dollars. What is this MMT?
Well, you are living and breathing the new modern monetary theory. It's not really new. It's old. And if we go back to our elementary economics textbooks, it used to be called pump priming. And that's exactly what the Japanese did all during the 1990s and what we're doing now. The interesting thing is that pump priming didn't do the Japanese economy any good in the 1990s. And the open question is whether it will do us any good in this environment. Basically, what it is simply deficit spending, spending money you don't have, spending money until the cows come home, borrowing that money, and hoping that it has a real economic effect without causing major imbalances in the economy. And, of course, the height of absurdity is that they say, well, don't worry about it, because if something bad happens, we always have the tools to fix it. Hogwash.
Yeah. Like you said, I mean, the 90s are the lost decade for Japan.
Exactly.
Why would we expect any other results?
Well, well, because we're different.
Oh, okay.
The theory is that, if you throw enough money at the economy, something's going to stick and is going to have an impact on boosting economic activity. And then, of course, in the post-World War II period, after World War II or during World War II, we ran up a tremendous amount of debt. And in the post-World War II period, we embarked on a long period of uninterrupted economic growth. And because we kept interest rates down and were fortunate enough not to have any inflation, we gradually worked off that debt and it didn't become a problem until the whole thing started all over again beginning in the mid-1960s. And their theory is that now is the same thing. You know, we had this external shock in the form of the pandemic. We're throwing money at the economy in order to boost economic activity. We're going to have a big economic recovery, and eventually we're going to pay off this debt with the faster economic growth that we're going to get as a result of all of this. And, of course, to cap things off, they say, well, you know, the big problem coming out of the financial crisis in 2008, 2009 was that we didn't spend enough. And so, therefore, they say, well, we're not going to make that mistake again. We'd rather spend too much than not enough. And that's just a false premise. The reason that the stimulus package in 2008-2009 didn't have the desired effect on the economy is because, number one, they spent it in the wrong areas. Number two, there were institutional problems in the mortgage market. And number three, the Obama administration, they neutered the banking system, and you couldn't generate that money flow through the economy. Here, what we're doing is we're spending until the cows come home, and meanwhile, we're not spending it in the areas that we should be. Instead of funneling money to those most seriously affected by the pandemic, we're just throwing paint against the wall and hoping that it sticks. And so what we're going to wind up with is a mismatch in the labor market, and that a lot of those jobs that were lost in the pandemic are not going to be recouped. And then a year from now, when they see that there's still this army of unemployed because they didn't retrain them, they're going to say, well, we still have to take care of these people, so let's try universal basic income.
Yep, yep.
And that'll be the capstone of modern monetary theory.
Yep, that's it certainly feels like that is the direction that we are pointed. Now, there are those that will argue that as long as the U.S. dollar remains the default currency, the fiat currency, the currency of trade around the world, that we can get away with this.
Is there anything to that? Well, of course, one of the things that makes it easier or postpones the inevitable is if you have a central bank and you do have the reserve currency. You know, so we're fortunate in that respect for the time being. But, you know, markets are funny, as we know. And you know from the grain markets, you know from the agricultural markets, you know from the credit markets. Everything's fine until it's not fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then when they decide that it's not fine, Katie bar the door.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so the what did they call the – it is the American Rescue Plan or something like that?
Yeah.
What are the odds? I mean, is it going to work?
Well, in the short run, it's going to work. I mean, you know, you're going to throw a lot of money at the economy. You're going to give a lot of money, $1,400 stimulus payments. You're going to give a lot of subsidies at the lower end of the income scale. There's a disincentive to work as a result of this because the subsidy payments are so generous that, you know, in the lower end of the labor market, you can make more staying home than working. And so I suspect that as the economy reopens in here, you're going to see a lot of help wanted signs at bars, restaurants, and you know, and those that employ service workers, because those people are going to say, what the hell do I want to work for?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. If you could target one area in particular, wouldn't you target that lower income consumer?
Well, that's certainly what I've been arguing for, is that you should be directing aid to the people, to the groups, not only money, but in particular job retraining programs. You know, what we're going to find, especially if these people follow this plan through with some sort of infrastructure program, what we're going to find is that we're going to have a shortage of electricians, a shortage of welders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
We've already got that.
And instead of retraining the waiters and the janitors to be welders and electricians, we're letting them sit home and trade on Reddit.
Yeah, that I don't know how to say it any more clearly than how you just said it, Vince. And when you take a look at some of the jobs that you described, plumbers and welders, we've already got a shortage of them, and these are great paying jobs that are available to these guys.
Exactly, and of course, what's going to happen? I mean, the housing market's been red hot, and the manufacturing sector has been red hot. So what you want to do is create an infrastructure program to make those areas of the economy that have been running red hot even hotter.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's how you generate price pressures. And then what happens if we're unfortunate and we do generate price pressures? Well, guess who those price pressures hurt the most?
Right. Consumers.
The unemployables.
Right. Oh, the unemployables. Gotcha. Yes.
You know, the people that we're trying to help.
Yep, yep, yep. Very good. Vince, thank you, buddy. We just need to check in with you from time to time. We'll be doing that. That is Dr. Vince Malanga. He is the president of LaSalle Economics.
It starts with a plan. That's why America's Conservation Ag Movement is inviting you to get your farm business ready for 2021 with a free resource stewardship planning guide. Get your free guide today at agweb.com/ACAM.
Davis, I normally don't pull any headlines from Pro Farmers First Thing today until we get to the afternoon hour of AgriTalk, which, by the way, starts at 2:06. For everybody out there.
Don't
but
miss it.
I am going to pull a headline right now. from First Thing Today. 1 year ago, the World Health Organization declared the COVID-19 outbreak pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1 year ago today that it was declared a pandemic, and it threw a lot of industries into turmoil. And I don't know if we disrupted any other industry more than what the restaurant industry was disrupted. And Mike Watley and Sean Kennedy from the National Restaurant Association have been so generous with their time throughout the year, keeping us updated with what's going on. And we've got Mike Watley back. Mike is the VP of State Affairs and Grassroots Advocacy for the National Restaurant Association. He joins us now. Mike, welcome back. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, guys. Happy almost spring. I realize
yeah.
it's been a month since we've chatted.
Yeah, exactly. Was this the longest year you think you've ever experienced, Mike?
It's certainly been a crazy year, and it's even crazier that we're coming up on the one-year anniversary of the first restaurant shutdowns in Ohio. It's been a busy year for us, but it's been an even busier year for restaurateurs and operators across the country. It's just been crazy.
Yeah, yeah. A year ago next week, I was on vacation with my wife, and obviously we were enjoying the restaurants along the Gulf Shores is where we were a year ago, and we were there when the restaurants started to shut down, and it was just the weirdest thing. It was so strange. So let's get to where we're at right now. Inside of the American Rescue Plan is the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. How big is it, and is it big enough to buy enough time for restaurant owners to get back to quote-unquote normal operations?
So I think when we were talking last time, it was in December, which was right after Congress had passed the second round of Paycheck Protection Program funding, which was really an important bridge to get us from there to today. But both PPP Part 1 and PPP Part 2 were really just down payments on a larger recovery effort. And we're very optimistic that the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, or RRF, is the beginning of that additional funding that will help the industry. So it's $28.6 billion. It's part of the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, which is, I believe, now on President Biden's desk for signature. So this is a big pot of money, and it's really important. And it's going to help restaurateurs get through the rest of the pandemic. PPP 1, PPP 2, kept a lot of restaurants open and kept a lot of employees employed who might have otherwise not been able to. This next part is an important piece in the puzzle, and we're hopeful that it'll be that bridge towards recovery. But, we continue to need more, not to say we're always asking for more, but this has been a huge, huge crisis for the industry, unprecedented. And while there's certainly optimism on the horizon, we still have a couple more tough months ahead of us as yeah. the rest of the population gets vaccinated.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that and the reopening, because we've got Texas has reopened and they can go to full capacity. Are they going to full capacity in Texas at the restaurants, or are consumers still a little hesitant to do that?
So Texas and a couple of other states are looking, or Texas has done full capacity, and other states are looking at it too, which is important. And the ability to have full capacity is a great step in the right direction for restaurants. But I think to the point you were hinting at, we also need full consumer confidence, because just
yes.
because you can have a full restaurant doesn't mean you're going to have a full restaurant per se. So, I've seen some consumer sentiment data. It's definitely heading in the right direction. But you're still looking at a sizable chunk of the population that does not feel comfortable dining in a restaurant yet. Many of them are waiting until they've had the vaccine or until community spread continues to go down. Cases are trending in the right direction. Hopefully that continues. But we're probably looking at a couple of months, summer, fall, before everyone feels confident going back into a restaurant. And if you think about it, even in the best of times, restaurants have a 4-6% profit margin, so razor thin, and they rely on having a full house every single night just to get by. So we have to get back to that point and have everyone feel comfortable before we can have a true recovery.
Okay. So lay out your best case scenario, Mike. What does it look like for the restaurant industry? Is it 50, 75, 100% of pre-pandemic?
That would be our hope. I don't think that's possible in 2021. We're probably looking at 2022 for that to happen, but things are definitely trending in the right direction. In talking with operators, we've heard a lot of pain and a lot of just misery and disappointment the last couple of months, or basically a year at this point. But in my conversations now, I'm starting to hear more and more hope. You have more federal stimulus money coming. You have declining caseloads, increasing vaccination rates. And also in many parts of the country, I'm in Virginia, it's a nice sunny day here, you're starting to see outdoor dining return. So, we're seeing positive signs on the horizon. But again, while other industries, retail and others, are talking about a recovery and are really heading in that direction, because restaurants require hospitality and people to be together, in order for us to get back to normal, everyone has to feel comfortable going out and celebrating again. And some people do, but we're not quite there yet in terms of everyone feeling comfortable with that.
Yeah. You used the phrase that we have used many, many times on AgriTalk, and it is that consumer confidence. Once we get the consumer confident, then we can really activate the recovery in the restaurant industry. Mike, thank you so much for your time, man. Appreciate you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it, as always.
You bet. That is Mike Watley. He is with the National Restaurant Association. Hey, come back this afternoon. Ben Brown, ag economist from the University of Missouri, is going to be with us tomorrow morning. It's a free-for-all. Wiesmeyer, Haney, and who let this happen? Tyne Morgan on the free-for-all? Oh, boy.